Okay, we're back. So I think we can move to off-balance sheet.
Okay.
I guess generally your view on off-balance sheet structures, do you think, this is kind of a loaded question, but do you think the whole idea of achievement of sale accounting, whether through QSPE or non-QSPE, and the ability to have the securitization trust off balance sheet for the sponsor. Is that part of the financial crisis story? Is that part of, is it part of the story? Is this part of what feeds the machine that enables us to write lots of mortgages?
So it's that's a hard one for me to evaluate, is what is actually the role of accounting in, you know, as you describe it, kind of feeding the machine. I suspect what's happened over time is, but this is just what I suspect, that is, as capital rules evolve at banks, or, you know, there's a greater and greater desire to push loans or things out the door and to free up capital, realizing that if you retain that, there is a, you know, a capital charge, if you will, finding structures to sell that. Not obviously at its core, if I originate loans and can sell the loan without any, you know, just say it's the, this isn't the accounting model, but just say this is the purest transaction you could find. There's, I originated the loan, I sold it, and there's no continuing involvement. Well, why would I have that on my balance sheet? And obviously, it would seem it should free up capital, and whether I do that into, you know, a securitization vehicle or any other, you know, to any other buyer, why should I consolidate that? I suspect that, at least in my way of looking at it, the role of accounting standards is more of one of trying to keep up with structures as opposed to saying, well, they led to an outcome or not. And I think that's, you know, securitization accounting. FASB starts out with, what is it, Statement 60 or Statement 70, dealing with, you know, sales of receivables, market practices continue to evolve. It's almost like this continuing game of almost catch up with what our market practices. So then we move to Statement 125 that says, yeah, you can keep a securitization. You know, here's the criteria. You got to have a legal sale. You know, no continuing control over the asset. But we then decide in both Statement 125 and 140, well, there's this special type of securitizations where. And I think the idea, kind of in the abstract, is one that I get how the standard setters at the time were persuaded that it would work, is if I sold assets into this entity that is completely brain dead, I put things on my balance sheet only if I have control over them. I could have some risk, but I don't typically put assets on my balance sheet unless they're assets I control. Okay. And if I could find an entity that is sufficiently, you know, predetermined that I as the sponsor don't really have any involvement with, you know, the notion was, well, then why would those assets be on your balance sheet? You're more of like a passive investor. Anybody else who took a piece of the, you know, the action with those assets doesn't put the full assets on their books. They just have whatever it is their retained or their owned interest is. But almost from the issuance of both, I think, Statement 125 and Statement 140, the questions then became, you know, how do you really have, and the term isn't used in accounting literature, the term brain dead, but that was kind of the notion. Is
the,
how do you?
They're droning. These are drone
right.
operations. It would not be another way to put it more positively.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
But how much then can the sponsor of that drone corporation be involved when there are actual real decisions that have to be made? So, you know, kind of at the safest end of the spectrum, if you're putting treasuries into a securitization vehicle and just paying out the cash flows to beneficial interest holders, you know, maybe there's never really any decisions to be made. But as soon as you start getting assets that have, you know, greater risk of default, or, you know, cash flows on your funding side don't mash up with cash flows on your asset side, can you really get a dynamic enough drone to figure out how am I going to respond when I need to go out and raise additional, you know, commercial paper, or there's a default on a commercial real estate piece of property. Somebody's got to manage the hotel property or whatever it is, you know, during that time period in which there's a default. Somebody's going to have to figure out, you know, when do we sell the property versus do we continue to manage. And I think that happened fairly early on after the issuance of 140.
So let me just be clear. So is this just for QSPs or that you're speaking?
So, yeah.
Because when I think of QSPs, it's predominantly, well, mortgages, credit cards, and student loans.
I think it's commercial real estate and Qs.
Yeah, okay. It may be a smaller piece of the...
I mean, those were some questions that predate me, but I think there were some pretty big questions in the kind of the mid...
Because it would be more difficult to figure out what are all the possible scenarios and kind of wire it into the contract that therefore makes it a brain dead end.
But I think there were a number of questions that came up of if there's a default on a commercial piece of real estate. And it was coming up in the context of Qs.
Okay.
Same thing happened... different aspect, but same question happened after Hurricane Katrina, where mortgages in the New Orleans, you know, the New Orleans and otherwise affected region, mortgagees were saying, "Look, I need some flexibility. I'm literally not even able to get into my property. The last thing I'm thinking about is how to get my mortgage payment to my lender in the next 30 days." One could look at a drone entity and say, well, how's that entity going to respond to whether or not we'll give you some forbearance to make your payments 90 days later? Mm-hmm. And so the question was, well, can you really have a QSPE if the underlying sponsor has the flexibility to give some forbearance for an event like Hurricane Katrina? And I think the guidance that we issued as a staff at the time said, look, this was really broader than what we thought, effectively than what we thought FASB was thinking about in the notion of a brain-dead entity. Similar questions continued to arise during the beginning time periods of the crisis of if you've got, and just myriads of interpretive guidance that had to be issued. So, for example, if you have this drone entity, but there's a default in, this is principally in the context of, mortgage-backed, asset-backed security, but there's a default. Does that invalidate the QSPE if the sponsor comes in and restructures the loan as a result of a mortgage default?
So they reach in and take the loan out of the securitization?
I think the guidance, although I'd have to go back and look, but I think the guidance actually lets you restructure within, although I think many took it out. But I think the Q&A actually, there's a FASB staff Q&A that I actually think allows you to keep it in and restructure within, as long as it's pre-specified kind of what the response would be, and then you get into a lot of interpretive questions about what is pre-specified mean, to the point where I think effectively the 140 model was caving in on its, at least the QSPE aspect of the 140 model was caving in on itself, because, and this is where I get back to, maybe not a bad idea at the time that you could have a drone entity, but all of the operational questions to what does it mean to be on autopilot, and particularly the more and more you push the quality spectrum of the assets you're putting into a QSPE, you're going to inevitably wind up with questions of bad things happen and humans need to intervene. The drone can't, the drone can't operate itself, which came up, and this was again kind of early in the crisis, questions about do you literally have to wait until a default occurs for a QSPE or a securitization vehicle to take action to restructure a loan, or can the sponsor either come in and buy out loans or restructure loans where default is reasonably foreseeable. Mm-hmm. It was an area where, I'm trying to think of the time frame, it was probably, it was either June or July of 07 where we were getting the question with sufficient frequency that we asked the FASB to hold a round table. I think it was June, if I recall right, was the round table, where bank regulators, securitizers, attorneys, us, firms, I think there were a couple of investor groups, I don't have the exact attendee list, but basically talked about this specific issue. And after that, both FASB and our sense was, the model is one that needs to be improved, but we wouldn't object to the view that you don't have to wait till technical default occurs. If you can determine with some degree of specificity that default is reasonably foreseeable, you could take action at that point.
So can I just, if this has come up in previous conversations, I just want to clarify. So I understand the concept that over time, we had a great idea about how QSPEs would work, and then over time, either through financial engineering, people want to, you know, they want to have more retain more control, and still achieve a QSPE structure, or I'm not sure, the expansion of the market for securitizations. Over time, things changed, and we now have QSPEs that are out there where it appears as though, I'm trying to understand, did the sponsor actually have these rights, and they were asking, what if I exercise these rights? Or was there a question of whether they had the rights? Because if they had the rights...
These questions always existed. My sense is, and I don't have, you know, massive, you know, empirical evidence to prove this, but my sense is the structures themselves, at least as it relates to QSPEs, right, didn't change that much over time. Mm-hmm. As lending standards declined, there were more and more subprime mortgages where the event of default was more and more likely, but the deal documents themselves were ones that probably best for, you know, someone like SIFMA or a securities attorney, but as I understand it, the deal documents are relatively, I mean, they evolve over time, but it wasn't like there was some fundamental shift as it related to Qs themselves. So the powers themselves, if you will, kind of always existed. It was just an observance over time that, hey, I've got loans that are defaulting, or I've got loans where default's reasonably foreseeable, okay, in quantities where people felt fairly compelled to act, okay, as opposed to kind of one-off, okay, well, I'm not going to go modify a bunch of loans in advance of default because I'll just wait for it. Okay. You know, I'll wait for it to happen. But at the point in time where people saying, look, we can't have, you know, 3 million entity, or, you know, 3 million borrowers actually sitting there just waiting for the default to occur. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of that was, you know, that was the same time period when you saw a lot of 228 or 327 loans, and so that those were starting at about, you know, kind of the June time frame of 07 to get into, many of these are going to start to reset over the next 6, right, 12 to 18 months. But the powers themselves in the documents, my sense is they didn't change. I mean, I'm sure they evolve over time, but I don't think in this area. And we talked, it was at that round table, there were securities attorneys that, you know, basically indicated you have, as a sponsor, you have fairly broad power as long as you're acting in the fiduciary best interest of, you know, the beneficial interest holders as a group. So as long as you can make that argument, even the words in the document don't mean too much.
Okay.
So was it that roundtable that led to the move to develop 167 and 168, or was that
so
the words?
So that was the kind of the beginnings of it, and then later in, I think it was later in 07, this was when Treasury was working on the streamline, mm-hmm, loan modification guidance. One of the questions was, if people aren't going through individual loan by individual loan and determining default is reasonably foreseeable, but they're using broad screening criteria consistent with the Treasury and the ASF screening criteria, can they conclude that likewise is reasonably foreseeable default so you can modify the loans? It was at that point we said, look, probably makes sense, but enough is enough in terms of the model. FASB, why don't you, one, go look at QSPEs and address the more fundamental question of, and we weren't necessarily saying eliminate QSPEs. That was certainly among the things we said think about, but either do that or come up with better criteria of what it means to be a drone or a, you know, entity on autopilot. At the same time, so that was one kind of piece of the securitization or off-balance sheet,
yeah,
accounting issues.
I just want to be clear, because I'm not, I don't have the requisite requirements committed to memory. I don't have a huge repository of transactions that I have that I can recall. So if they had the powers, then everybody must have agreed that even with those powers present, they qualified as QSPE. And then it was just a matter of interpreting the powers when there was an event of default, or right.
So I don't think the powers are, it's not spelled out that you can do this, 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 mm-hmm, this, this, and this in the document. It says, you know, the documents say, here are the things that are limited. And then the question becomes, if one of these events occurs, can I do this? I suspect that people were going through, auditors and others, saying, look, it looks entirely pre-specified and significantly limited, but not getting answers to the questions of, and probably not thinking, again, if you don't have lower quality assets or you're not seeing defaults, not saying, well, what would happen if, you know, this event that we never contemplated happening at the origination were to occur, where it otherwise looks like this thing is relatively constrained.
Okay.
So I don't think it was something where people were saying this entity has, you know, broad powers. And so for those powers, when bad things did happen, my sense is the profession generally said, well, those powers are, you know, kind of servicer powers, which has always been, you know, 140 allows servicer discretion, but it doesn't allow, you know, sponsor discretion. So the servicer has the ability to make some decisions that don't otherwise invalidate QSPE. And one of the questions that's going on since effectively the issuance of 140 is, where do I separate servicer discretion from, you know, sponsor discretion?
Oh, because that was my question. What if the servicer is the sponsor?
Yeah, and so the question is, how do I separate those two? And I think from, and you could, you know, FASB will probably give you, you know, since they've lived it since the issuance of 140, that it's been a struggle, both at the EITF and, you know, in interpretive questions that they've been getting or we've been getting, is what does it mean to have servicer discretion versus, you know, when is it something that the sponsor effectively maintains a level of control that's inconsistent with the QSPE?
So it feels like we've had some interpretive issues on 125 and 140 from the get-go.
Which was, thus the
it's
letter
not that
and...
Suddenly we came to Katrina and then the financial crisis and we said, oh, gee, the sponsors or servicers have more rights than we thought they did. Which
no,
means,
it's...
Because if that were the case, then you might look back and say, well, geez, some of these sales and off-balance sheet presentations in prior periods isn't correct.
But yeah,
I'm not getting that sense.
No, my strong sense is these have been issues that manifested themselves in the crisis that were no different than questions that have existed in the 140 model from its inception of, to the point where, and I think FASB could help you with this as well, where people look back and say the vision of what they thought they were doing when they created a QSPE is not the vision of what's operating in practice.
Like
you know, it's kind of, the cumulative impact of,
okay,
well, how do I answer this question? How, you know,
you mean the vision of what the QSPE is under 140 or the vision of what
the vision of what the board members thought they were saying when you have an entity that's on autopilot compared to
what
people were operating as entities on autopilots probably, you know, weren't recognizable over time.
I think people who didn't deal in FAS 140 and all the interpretive questions that have arisen over the years might have the same kind of view. Like, really? That qualifies? Because I read the plain vanilla words.
Was 150 partly response to Enron and trying to avoid some of the SPE problems that arose there, and they tried to get away from the extent of equity ownership ruling,
so,
move to a no equity ownership, but then they found out that the whole income from the process was moving out of equity and into all these fee commission servicing rights.
So that's the other piece of
structured
mm-hmm. Securitization or finance products, which is actually a standard called FIN 46 or FIN 46R, which was a response to getting away from a bright line if you have 3% equity and, you know, independent source of that equity that you could deconsolidate, to a model that, again, it's one when they issued, you could argue, the concept was, if you're the party that has the majority of the expected losses, not the potential, you know, when I first heard the model, I thought it was kind of, if you provided a majority of the financing, you consolidate. Their response to that was, well, that isn't really how things work in a voting, you know, a typical corporation. You could have, you know, 80% bank debt, you know, and 20% equity capital, but the person that owns all of the equity capital consolidates, not the bank, and it's because the equity capital is going to be the first to absorb the losses. So they were trying to replicate that idea in a kind of a non-voting interest entity of saying, well, you consolidate if you have the majority of losses that are expected if you absorb a majority of the losses expected to occur, and it's where you saw things like sieves getting created, where a bank might have a fairly significant continuing interest in the sieve, but what it would do is create a class of securities called expected loss notes that were specifically designed. The entity would say, well, I expect losses to be $1 million, so I need to sell securities that will absorb the first, 500, 1,001 of losses.
So those loss notes absorb the majority of the losses.
The expected losses.
Expected losses.
And so, one, it was based on expected losses, so you could argue, well, in a structured entity, should it be some higher level than just expected losses? And then, two, even where people were doing their best to price risk, where people really, because the modeling that might not capture every loss, were people really doing a good enough job? And I don't mean from an accounting standpoint even, but was the market doing a good enough job at pricing risk? So did you really have, was that security holder really absorbing 50% of the economic losses? And it's hard to tell because obviously economics can change and expected losses can be, actual losses can be bigger than expected.
So, but it's good benchmark is the is Enron, because now sometimes you'll hear people say, well, geez, who knew about all this off balance sheet stuff? And some of the it seems though we're kind of going through this whole shock of Enron, like what is all this off balance sheet stuff? But it's been relatively common knowledge and even better disclosed since FIN 46 and over time.
Yeah, I think the disclosures have increased significantly. And again, even the idea that you would consolidate based on expected losses at the time didn't seem, might have been more complex than it needed to be, but it didn't seem like, a bad idea. But having seen two issues that I think make it challenging. One is, can people actually appropriately price expected losses? And then two, in some cases, it actually seemed to get away from, I pretty clearly have control of these assets and I have a lot of risk. Maybe I should just default to saying I consolidate the entity, which was a second piece of what we then asked the FASB to respond to is, as opposed to focusing on a precise mathematical calculation so somebody could get just $1 over the expected loss limit and argue they don't have to consolidate, is maybe you ought to take a look at, is there a mix of, which is the principle they issued in 166 and 167, if I have a majority of, or I'm sorry, if I have control, so I make, a majority of the important decisions, not that this is going to solve all questions, or there'll still be interpretive questions, but if I have the power to direct the activities and I have a significant interest in the entity, maybe I don't have to focus so precisely on whether it's $1 more than someone else.
The FIN 46R model, which was heavily quantitative dependent, would enable people to either potentially miss stuff that should be included in the quantitative analysis or manage the quantitative analysis. And as you say, size the expected loss tranche so that no one ends up having to consolidate.
Or miss the forest through all that quantitative analysis by saying, can I take a step back and figure out that I have control over these assets.
Right.
So I'm hopeful that that's going to be responsive to the issues we saw in practice.
So the new model under 167 is more qualitative.
Yeah, it is. Yes. You may have to get into the math if you go through all your qualitative analysis and you need to break the tie, but the first step is, do I have power and do I have a significant interest?
Right. You have to have both of those things. So, big picture, there still seems as though there's potentially, you may
people
have to change
to make
your
judgments.
Business model,
yeah.
But you could potentially still manage around the standards because you got to have both significant exposure or interest,
right.
Economics, and
so you can, I guess, if you say manage around the standard. Although, if you don't have a significant interest, one might say, why would you put assets on? Depending on what you think significant means. If I have a 2% interest in a in a pool of assets, why should I show 100% of those assets on my my books?
What is the interest? Is the interest? I guess I should ask in 67. more broadly to define and say, well, I'm getting income from it because I've got an interest rate swap because I'm hedging the long into the short end of that thing. I've got some sales commission on whatever transactions are involving. I'm placing the commercial paper, so I'm getting some dealer commissions on that. You know,
it is broader. Whether and it includes things like servicing.
So it's not just the assets.
It's not, yeah, it's not the assets. The relationship.
Income generated
right.
by the entity itself.
The most difficult piece to deal with, and I think it was in FIN 46R, and I think it will continue to be, is it's pretty clear that you have to include, well, not pretty, it is clear, you have to include the broader relationship. The area where I think people will continue to struggle is this issue of, do I have an implicit interest in a group of assets? So I can look at both my fee and, my assets that I own and the decision making, and I can say, well, I have decision making, but I don't have any other interest in the asset group. But it's a I'm Bank X. It's a Bank X, special purpose vehicle.
X out of Bank
X. And if it goes bad, am I actually, even though I don't have a legal obligation, am I going to step up and make investors whole? And I think that's an incredibly difficult accounting question. I'm not sure you'll ever get an accounting model that can deal perfectly with, other than through disclosure of, here's the nature of the relationship and here's what I may or may not do, because you're starting to account for things that go beyond the counterparty's contractual rights and hypothesizing about what you might do in a failure.
What I might do, and I don't know what I'm going to do until that event actually occurs.
And the standard actually tells you you need to figure out whether you have one of these.
Right.
But it's pretty difficult up front to say, well, I don't think I have one, but 5 years later, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. So some of the
have such sterling reputations, they have no way to value
it's
your reputation.
We've got that crystal ball.
Some of the off-balance sheet structures that failed and caused assets to come on balance sheet and losses to be incurred were
ones where there was this implicit.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult issue to deal with. From an accounting standard standpoint.
But a lot of that was backed up by some, at least to some extent, by lines of credit. Okay. So it was they could have probably lowered, they took on more than they were contractually required to, but they were part of that was contractual.
I think that's right, yeah. There were liquidity puts and other things where you had a contractual obligation, and then some of it went even further than that of saying, well, I feel a sense of responsibility.
Right. In some cases, it could have just been, for example, if you take this liquidity put, if you did your projections and you figured that, 0.1% of the time the liquidity puts would be in play, then there's not a lot of expected loss that would come to that or that would come to you via those liquidity puts. So that gets back to the potential.
Yeah, so now you would just put that in the mix.
Model.
The liquidity itself, you would say, well, if it's a significant amount of liquidity, then I have a significant interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes that piece easier. It just doesn't make any easier the piece that goes beyond your contractual obligations.
Okay.
But that definitely is part of your deleveraging story.
More off balance? Anything else off balance sheet?
I don't think so. Any questions?
No. I want to talk about, I want to make sure we get to FRR 48, the market risk disclosure.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've spent a little bit of time getting up to speed on the requirements, looked at some filings. I'm just curious, kind of, do you have views on the market risk disclosure? Do you think that they've been effective, useful?
So I don't know. I haven't done a study recently of, do we think there is room for improvement in market risk disclosure? I think the release itself was put in place kind of post-air products, where there were some derivative failures while FASB was working on 130, the guidance that became the derivative guidance, which I think, the idea of which is extremely useful, that you ought to understand more about what will, given all the contracts I have in place, what will be the likely outcome if, XYZ event you know, could happen in the future does happen. I suspect that it would continue to be an extremely challenging issue if you were to say, for example, there's in the market risk disclosure three ways that one can, well, it requires, let's take a step back, it requires both qualitative and quantitative disclosure about market risk, and it includes derivatives and other financial instruments that expose you to significant risk of interest rates, changes in foreign currency, but did not include, as I understand it, credit risk. So it's not, it wasn't trying to get to credit risk disclosure. That's not that that's not required either in the filing or in the financials or in MD&A, but so it's really, if markets move, given all the contracts and assets or investments I have in place, what is going to be the impact on me? Was MD&A disclosure that was put in place, again, pre-133, the FASB guidance that existed at the time, which was, I think, Statement 119,
right,
which I don't actually know the accounting requirement. This predates my understanding in terms of what was the actual accounting under Statement 119. It wasn't mark-to-market for all derivatives, but
it had a different, a smaller scope, I think. Than
less was mark-to-market, and hedge accounting was easier, but it did require more quantitative information about derivatives in the financial statements themselves. And so 133 gets issued, that creates its own disclosure requirements, and FASB actually takes out a number of, or basically for trading derivatives or derivatives that aren't hedges, basically takes out all of the quantitative disclosure, but still makes you provide qualitative disclosure about your strategies and what types of derivatives you enter into.
So 133, if you kind of look at it now without that history, it really is oriented around hedge accounting.
It is, and saying the things that aren't hedging, will you get fair value information, and that's enough.
Right. But the specific requirements that were dropped when we moved from 119 to 133 is footnote disclosure on types. I'm not sure if it's types. There's a different term that's used in 119, right, but it was fair value and notional amounts of trading derivatives by some categorization, which I might think, but I'll ask the FASB whether they have any... what they intended, and then if they, what they saw from preparers, what they were actually disclosing. So that a little bit more granularity about the types of derivatives that are out there and the fair value and notional amounts was dropped from moving from 119 to 133. The market risk disclosure came in
like pre-133,
post 119, right, pre-133. So once 133 came in,
you didn't get as much information. You still got it about. So I think the disclosures are
disclosure in the market risk.
Right, but I think
but
they're
it
different.
Going to be the same type of information that had been previously required.
And I think they're kind of different purposes. The market risk disclosure, and this is why I'm not sure that there's really a need to do much more on the market risk disclosures, because the idea was, what would be the impact of a change in the market? Again, you can ask whether there should be three methods, or, you know, could that be more standardized? Where the FASB's disclosure, I think, was the idea was it was much more focused on not what is the impact of a change, but give me a sense for how, I'll use this term kind of loosely, but how soft are the numbers? So give me more information about, you know, one could ask, well, shouldn't I have more information about the assumptions you used or the amount of, you know, notional underlying, so I have a better sense for what derivatives you actually have. Mm-hmm. It wasn't to say, well, here's how these derivatives might respond if there is a change in the market. And so in that respect, I think they were two different purposes. And and if you go back and look at the basis for conclusions in 133, I think they effectively, at least believed at the time, maybe falsely, was that by providing people fair value information about trading derivatives, you didn't really need. And I think they got this kind of in spades from the preparer community of, it's not really useful for people to know how much I have as a notional, because you also need to know things like strike and, you know, term of the option or term of the derivative. And if you just provide one of those in the abstract, or you say, well, here's my aggregate notional, but the strikes are all over the place, do you really get enough that it's going to be useful information? I think FASB, obviously having thought about that some more, said, yes, you do. Maybe we shouldn't be so prescriptive as to how tell you how to talk about your exposure, but give us some order of magnitude of what is the volume of derivatives you enter into. If it isn't meaningful to talk about notionals, figure out a way to give us, you know, give the reader a sense for the volume of derivatives. And to the extent where they now require much more granular, here's my trading, or here's my non-hedge derivatives, you know, broken out by risk exposure.
Right. So
we've been having this discussion about credit derivatives and how they should be disclosing. I mean, the biggest losses that occurred to the financial community happened on one-way bets on what was supposedly AAA tranches of CDOs through credit derivatives. And we're kind of trying to figure out what would have been useful in advance and what versus what was required, and was what was required reasonable in retrospect.
Credit derivatives are different than other derivatives.
And this is saying, the notional value of credit derivatives actually is the most important fact. So, you know, what does that tell us about
the max exposure, if you think kind of 1046R terminology, the max exposure for credit derivatives is closer to the notional than it would be for other types of derivatives. So would it have been useful to have that kind of max exposure information disclosed about credit derivatives? And then if yes, the answer is yes, then would we want the entire credit derivatives portfolio disclosed? Would we want concentrations within, you know, so do we look to the product credit default swaps and say, I want to know if there's a concentration within that
type. Mortgage backs or municipal securities,
this, you know,
or
40% of my notionals with one customer. Do I want to know that?
So, well, I haven't, you know, one at one level, MD&A is all about if there are risks that are in, you know, entirely disproportional, whether, you know, credit risk. There's already, you know, required disclosure.
Concentration of credit risk.
Yeah,
it's not going to get down to the product level, right? So if we're talking, I've got big conglomerate bank, investment bank, broker dealer, all under one reporting entity. If a portion of that entity is writing credit default swaps, and I have a concentration within credit default swaps, I'm not sure that's going to come through the.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look. Does it say, you know, I haven't looked at the exact words, but does it say, you know, concentration with a single counterparty, or is it, and I don't know, I can go back and look
like
and get back to you.
Geography, counterparty, I don't know what the other categories
are. Yeah, I mean, I could go, you know, whether there is a broader reading of, you know, I don't think the idea was to say there could be significant concentrations of credit risk. You know, and it's again, if there's an issue, it's something we can look at. But I don't think it was to be prescriptive of saying, no, you can ignore concentrations if they're not of this nature. I mean, that's just typically not how MD&A guidance was written. So one, I think there is now more disclosure of maximum, you know, FASB's, what is the FSB?
One that predated 161.
Yeah, which I think
was
kind of
Q4 2008.
Yeah, so it's, you know, we're now some point beyond the beginnings of the crisis, but well, 161 wasn't added as a response to the crisis itself. I think it was a realization over time that there are growing uses of derivatives for other things, and thinking back to the 119 days of whether or not some of the more quantitative detail was useful. I don't know the exact, and I can find out, or if FASB doesn't know the exact date it was added, but my understanding it was kind of predates.
It predates the crisis. I think it was, I don't even know, it might have been issued before the crisis.
I don't think it was finalized before the crisis, but it was certainly added before the crisis.
Yeah.
And I think
161. That's 161.
Which requires much more quantitative information about derivatives.
They were taking comment letters in 2005.
And I think it was in response, at least in part, to, you know, Corp Fin observations that, hey, it would be useful to improve disclosure by having more quantitative information about derivatives.
Yeah. We definitely have better information now, but even so, if we look at that required disclosure, it's only going to be the total of credit derivatives or credit default swaps. And just wondering if there's, is there more that would be useful to have? because of the nature of those derivatives. They're a little different from other derivatives because the max exposure can go, you're can have an exposure on your balance sheet of basically zero, no fair value, and suddenly, from what we've seen,
well, yeah, it's a lot of fairly binary payouts, at least if it's a single issue or guarantee. Although presumably the fair value shouldn't go from zero to max exposure if the market is and the issuer is operating at all, determining an appropriate value, which should you should see a story over time. Not that it can't happen, not that those changes can't happen very quickly, but you shouldn't see zero without any warning signs and suddenly we're at the max exposure.
Right. And this is a little off topic. You would expect that a company who had potential exposure to credit default swaps or any kind of credit derivative would have some sort of controls in place so that they're able to anticipate and be ready for when perhaps the value would change.
Yeah, one would think you'd have some valuation methodologies, and of course there's at least one company that had to go in and adjust its valuations.
Sorry, which one are you referring to? AIG?
AIG.
Okay.
Although, I think even if you look at their filing, there is, I haven't gone back in a while, but looked pre-161, so this is why I think 161 was finalized after the crisis. But you could get a fairly decent amount of, even then, information about, you know, outstanding, you know, notional on CDS.
So I did see a trend over time that if you looked at numbers for, say, 2000, here's a perfect example. I pull a 2007 10K. There's some information about derivatives, not the company you mentioned, but another company, and no credit derivatives listed. And I don't recall, I think this was an NBNA disclosure, and it seemed as though it was useful information for people to kind of know what the exposures were. Fair value, perhaps there was notional, definitely fair value information. Then I pulled the 2008 10K. They've got that same chart with another line item that says credit derivatives on it, 2008, with a comparative 2007 number, which I don't understand that. I mean, we've seen that there's additional disclosure as companies went through the credit crisis, the financial crisis. Certainly people were asking and they may have perceived their exposures differently, so they provided more granular information. But that type of a change where in 1 year I didn't say anything about credit derivatives, and the next year not only do I talk about it, but I also present the prior year information, seems particularly troubling. No, I would call that to be Goldman. Yeah.
I mean, the monoline certainly started to disclose more at the end of 07 and early 08 under huge market pressure.
Yeah, and you know that was part of the, you know, Corp Fin Dear CFO letter that I don't think it was prescriptive about give us, you know, I don't think that's the comparables, but I know that the Dear CFO letter, I'm not even going to get close to the right time on this one, so I'm not even going to engage it, but it was part of it was on, it wasn't a focused on credit derivatives itself, it was level 3 assets, but then it talked for a lot more granularity about your exposure. Can you give a sensitivity analysis? Are you, you know, I think questions about do you have concentrations of risk?
So those
calling for, it may have prompted, but it wasn't saying, well, go back and redo
prior.
You know, if you have an error, obviously you've got to, you know, deal with that. But it was, hey, watching the crisis unfold, we think that people need more and more information about the following types of things. Please think about this as you draft your MD&A.
Okay. So that was, is that public? Can we get that?
It is. Yeah. If you can't find it, it's on our website under...
You know how to do that.
Yeah. I hadn't really focused on it because I don't know, so I thought of it linking directly into derivatives, but it's more...
I think, well, part of...
It's the one that you said when it was March 2008.
Okay. The reason I would link it into derivatives is it was in part a response to doing fair values really, really hard, and
right.
So the derivatives are in level 3, and so
right.
It was a lot, you know, asking for where it's relevant, a lot more granular types of disclosure about, you know, kind of level three assets as a group, and including derivatives. But it wasn't, to my recollection, saying, well, there's a particular focus on, you know, CDS or something like that.
Okay. And the intent of those letters is not to change what's required, but to provide these CFOs with some thoughtful advice in applying the rules that are already present?
Well, and a balance between, you know, people are watching, so make sure you're complying with the existing rules, but to the extent you're really... I think that the spirit really is, if you want some thoughts that we think would be helpful in crafting your MD&A as well, here's some things that you ought to think about, as opposed to, you know, a Corp Fin review process that goes in after the fact and you say, well, I can't really find any, you know, technical non-compliance, but I think this disclosure could have been more clear if you had done the following. And then, you know, as you've seen, many of those end up in kind of what we call future, or Corp Fin calls futures comments, as in future filings. You know, please do something. The idea was, if we can help you up front, we don't need to then come in and say, in future filings, do this, with a reminder that, hey, comply with. In some of them, what was the last one that we did on loan losses, actually talks about, you know, and don't think that any of this, and say it this way, but effectively don't think that any of this is an excuse not to comply with existing standards.
Can I take a very brief digression? I think at this point, with the what we've been talking about are accounting for basically fair value, or even possibly, I'm getting a little bit of a sense of a VAR. But what we're not getting is, I think, what's really missing leading up to the crisis is a sense of direction. Do you know how much your firm is long home mortgage risk, or even oil risk? Is your firm, how long is Goldman long petroleum? Or is it short petroleum, or is it short mortgage risk? You know, so it's not just the fair value, because you could have a positive net fair value and just be short as the day is long, right? And vice versa. And so if I'm an investor, what I kind of need to know to price the firm is, given my view of the market price risk on the wide array of instruments out there, are these guys long or short on this? When I buy a gold mining company, are they long gold or short gold? Are they so short in the derivatives market that a mining company is short? Right, so where does that fit into all this? I don't hear that. Am I overlooking something, or is where does this fit in here?
I'm not sure. Let me just posit this for a minute. For one thing, if you're talking about a trading company, what's reported on the balance sheet every 90 days can be very different from what's on it, you know, a day or 5 days later. So this is a snapshot in time.
Right.
So even if you had the granularity you're asking for, it tells you something about at that point in time.
That's fair.
But I do think
some of the broader directional things I'm kind of thinking about here are not something you're going to reverse that much that quickly, right?
So, and so part of me wonders, you know, is there a need for different types of information on a more regular basis to answer those types of questions rather than just
the role
periodic
of
filings?
Or what's the role of, and there should be a role for MD&A if, you know, again, at the highest level, MD&A is supposed to be a description of the business through management's eyes. Presumably management understands throughout the period, my strategy has been to be, you know, 90% long, you know, 90% of my assets long in the mortgage market.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's a question that I think people are continuing to look into internally, is, you know, both from two aspects. One, is there a need for any improvements to MD&A? And then secondly, whether there's cases that folks in enforcement or otherwise ought to be looking at.
Because our hedge accounting says that within a 2 standard deviation movement, my derivative hedge has to be within 85 and 120 or whatever percent of the thing I'm hedging. And then, but when I'm coming, but why can't a comparable statement be made about my more proprietary role in this, saying that, you know, for, you know, we're a mining company, and, you know, for a 2 standard deviation movement in gold, we're, you know, up this or down that. I mean, you could sort of without giving away too much detail.
It seems like that type of information would come through the market risk disclosure. No.
No, I think it does combined with...
Is it directional or is it just... You know, that's what I'm thinking. There's one is to say, yeah, we've got... Our value at risk is an absolute value measure. Right? It doesn't tell you...
It's supposed to be... Well, so there's two pieces of the market risk disclosure, which is the quantitative, which is the value at risk or the tabular or the sensitivity, and there's supposed to also be then the qualitative. What are my derivatives? Or, you know, what is my market strategy? I suspect that over time that's something that people have to push on. What's the balance between giving enough about that where I'm not giving away proprietary? I also think it's an important reminder for the FASB as they're thinking about increase, you know, if they increase the role of fair value, that I think there's, at least in some accountants' minds, a perception that fair value is what you need to know. But if you don't have it in context...
Yeah, if you don't have the first derivative, if you will, of that, then... You don't know the direction. Right. So you really, you think when I buy Goldman, am I going long mortgage or short mortgage? Right? And then also, too, as an investor, you could say, oh, well, look, Goldman's changed its directional. It was long, now it's flat, now it's short.
So that should be coming
quarters, that should come through, and I don't hear anyone saying, oh, no, I read it in their 10Qs. You could see them going from long to short, long to flat to short. Because I don't think the directional stuff gets doesn't seem
whether there's enough focus on the quantitative behind the qualitative.
Yeah, and that's something that notional per se won't get you. So you have to go to, if you will, sort of the delta and the gamma of their derivatives portfolio to get in there.
I don't know if anybody's looked at the filings with that kind of a perspective for that company or another company, but. Because, and I'm only sensitive to that because I've heard a number of people say, for example, Citigroup didn't disclose the liquidity puts, but in fact, they did. It's a matter of finding that, the disclosure, that it's in there. So, I don't know if anybody's been looking to see.
Because that's probably part of their banking book, is those lines of credit, aren't, isn't it?
But all I'm saying is, I only use Citi as an example because people have asserted in the public domain as well as private conversations that Citigroup didn't disclose the liquidity puts. But if you actually go back and look at the filings, it's in there. So in this case, I haven't looked at the filings to know whether or not that information can be gleaned from the filings and how it would be done. Mm-hmm. Some of the things I'd look to are the things we've talked about, the market risk disclosure, what level of derivative information is presented, and then see how that trends over time. But I don't, and even after looking at that, I'm not sure if you'd be able to know that they're long or short mortgages.
I mean mortgages as a shorthand for saying
the real estate market.
Real estate assets, I'm sort of long that class of asset or short that class of asset or commodity. So thing. When I approach these accounting rules, I'm sort of thinking, okay, but you know, ultimately what are we trying to get to here? And we're trying to get to better informed investors by having standard ways of interpreting financial statements so that I can compare and so on. And so, but ultimately, the static value of the net fair value of the derivatives is not irrelevant. But going forward, it's the expected change in that is what we're kind of really concerned about. And without some idea of the directional position, so you can put all the notionals here, and if you don't know if they're calls or puts, or if they're long calls or short calls, you know, then all I can say is a whole lot's going to happen. But you know,
you got a lot of fair value today, and it can really move a lot of different ways.
Yeah. So it just it's so.
And I think that's part of the, you know, FRR 48, and it's also part of 133. But whether or not, you know, in the individual financial institution can be clearer, particularly with respect to the quantitative. Here's where I sit in the marketplace as it relates to, you know, mortgages.
Voluntarily, they're going to say that's proprietary information. It's a problem. They're going to hoard that information. There's no way of giving you a lien. Right? That's just... That's why regulatory disclosure is so important.
Well, and
they want to hoard it, and everyone else wants them to disclose it. So what are we doing? You know?
But the clarity of the existing filings, I didn't have a chance, just given the timing of this meeting, to sit down with our people in Corp Fin. I mean, they're in a the largest financial institutions are in a continuous review, so they have a lot better sense, at least day to day, what are they seeing in the filings? Is that an issue? I mean, one, I'd be happy to sit down with them, or Jane, if you want to.
In some regards, the question you're trying to answer is going to require slugging through the narrative year over year.
I see.
That's what I think. I mean, just to.
Yeah, what
just
is
to go
you know, what
the
is
market risk disclosure for an entity for a period of years, that's a lot of information. If you then want to expand more broadly, see what they've disclosed for risk factors and more broadly in MD&A, also what's in the footnotes, you got to piece it all together. So, which is one of the things when Greg and I talk about disclosure that comes up is you'd like to know the answer to that, but if to get to the answer to that, you're going to add 20 or 200 pages to the filing, is that really going to help?
Yeah.
Investors, right?
Yeah. Investors don't want a haystack.
Right, exactly. You want to know what you want to know before you know you need to know it, I think, right? Right? Is that ultimately, yeah.
And if it was a different risk that panned out, then you should have known that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, okay. Let's see. What else do you have? Anything more in derivatives?
I don't think so.
Any concerns about the accounting model for derivatives, other than potentially what we talked about for credit derivatives, with regards to disclosure?
I mean, the model itself, I don't think any accountant could be proud of the complexity around hedge accounting.
Well, yes, hedge accounting, but for financial institutions, hedge accounting is a relatively small piece
of understood.
So more trading derivatives.
Yeah, no, I mean, you got the same complexities of determining fair value with complex derivatives as you do for a lot of other level three assets.
Okay.
Other than that, I mean, the accounting model, I think, is pretty clear.
Okay. Let me make sure I have anything from my list. I know. In the FIR 48, it indicated at the time the guidance was issued, allowed for the three different ways to do it,
right,
and some, you know, ability to choose which methods you use for which types of risks. And there was a view that because this area was evolving, that flexibility made sense, and then at some point in time, the SEC would review the effect of FRR 48. So do you know if a review was done? And then what the results were?
My understanding was we did a one-year review. I think that was made public, but the results of the one-year review.
But that would be really old, right?
Yeah, it would have been like 2008.
Oh, okay.
Because FRR 48 was put in, or no, I'm sorry, 98. It would have been 98. FRR 48 was put in place in 97. So I think in 98 we did a study.
Anything was
quick description. My quick description. I think that the 97 or the 98, so the 1 year study. I think it was publicly released.
Okay.
My quick description would be: we studied it after 1 year, and we didn't find anything to say that the rule needs to be improved. But it's only 1 year, and so we need more years of.
Jane, I had a couple questions. If you could answer them, we don't need to take up this time.
Okay.
Would like to know, though, is how you account for variation margin payments on OTC derivatives. And two, when you post collateral on an OTC derivative transaction, how do you account for that, both under the case of it being segregated, or whether it goes into your general funds or is non-segregated?
Oh.
We'll have to get one of them.
Yeah.
133. I mean, we got people that could.
And I'm thinking this less important for 133 because it's more of a for your mark-to-market situation for the guys that are not using it for a bona fide hedge, but people that are, you know, Goldman and Morgan Stanley.
Right.
When you're trying to look at your balance sheet and people are paying in variation margin payments or people are posting collateral, then how does that pop up? And when I see the 10 Qs and Ks, and I see, okay, these are, you know, securities held under security lending arrangement, you know, those are some of the...
But that's a little bit different.
I mean, I'm happy to get one of our... I mean, this is more how does the accounting work. I'm happy to get one of our, you know, 133 experts who would tell me you know, yeah, that's how it's supposed to work, but there's, you know, this exception in paragraph whatever. I mean, I'd be happy to, whether it's Rachel or Wes.
That would be certainly useful for me.
So is it securities lending and repo accounting?
In my order of priorities, wanting to know this, it is first the variation margin payments and the collateral, both the segregated and the...
And the variation margin payments are a form of collateral?
No. Well, yeah, they are in a way. They are in a way, but it's considered different than what they call independent amounts or initial margin. For example, you know, we're two broker dealers. We reconciled at the end of the day. Today I'm up, you know, $10 million. You sent to avoid our current exposure getting out of whack. You send me $10 million. Now, on a futures exchange, that $10 million is just mine, right? I can take it home. And so, an OTC situation, if those, depending on how that's treated, those variation payments, two maybe just my cash, and I take them home. And so, which case, I guess that goes to my P&L as income efficiently, and that's
so
consistent with
cash. I don't know, but right. if I'm.
It's a way of me saying when I mark to market my position with you, the position goes up, but you pay me the cash, so that sort of moves my position back down, but I've got the cash.
Right.
So my assets are still improving by the $10 million, but now it shows, and this is my question, does it show up as cash? Or is it, and then my derivatives position with you, or overall with the market, doesn't look like it's gone up. Just suddenly, bing, I've got cash, right? Or whether somehow from the statement I can trace that I got this increment in cash due to the fact that I was essentially liquidating these the market value of my derivatives portfolio.
Which is why I think if we get two on the phone with Wes, I mean, he's
for him
or Rachel, they're going to be like, yeah, this piece of guidance is directly on point. Because I know there's guidance, but I start getting in a area where I'll give you misinformation if I start talking about the guidance on derivative, the accounting for derivative collateral netting. There's two or three fairly extensive pieces of guidance. I mean, Wes or Rachel will be all over
okay.
it.
Yeah.
It's one of those kind of things. It's a con. It's really hard for me to wait for them to teach myself. Maybe half an hour, some guy can just tell me, no, this is it, that's it, that it. I mean, I'll pick it up pretty quick if they can just...
Yeah, I think,
and I'll have the questions prepared, so you know we'll
they've operated in the space. So I think as soon as you start talking about how do you, you know, if they don't know what he's referring to, we'll get somebody that does.
Okay, sounds fine. Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.